And now to the intelligence that got us into this war. Intelligence is an inexact science, of course, as the Pentagon has been quick to remind us. But if you ask my next guest, many of our intel failures in Iraq can be chalked up to something much more humdrum, office politics. A.J. Rossmiller worked as an Iraq analyst in the Defense Department starting in 2004, and later he did a six-month rotation in Baghdad. Now he's written a book about his Pentagon days called Still Broken, a recruit's inside account of intelligence failures from Baghdad to the Pentagon. Hey, A.J.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So let's get to your story, or stories. You have a lot of them. fresh out of college, as you put it, you were exactly the kind of person the intel community wanted. You were young, committed, had a passion and a knowledge of the Middle East. And you managed to land a job with the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency. And your first challenge was to find a computer?
Yeah, it was certainly a bit of a surprise. You think of the intelligence agencies in the military as being sort of beyond a lot of the government bureaucracy, whether it's for movies or books. The idea that it's a well-run system is pretty ingrained, and it turns out not so much.
Yeah, I got to confess, reading your book bummed me out. It's like seeing the sausage made. I didn't want to know all this. And it's amazing how consistently throughout your tenure, you lack a computer, you never had voicemail, and you guys had like a plethora of flat screen TVs playing Fox News at your service all day long, right?
Yeah, it was, anytime we wanted to see the priorities, we could just sort of look up on the walls. As you said, there are long periods of time at the Pentagon where literally nobody in the Iraq office had voicemail, which, sounds like kind of a small thing until it's not, until there's something that, needs to be told immediately or information that needs to be passed on. And then all of a sudden it's a big deal. And again, it's, at that point, 3 years into war and now 5 years in, and these sort of basic things still aren't being taken care of.
Those are at least inconveniences. At most, how dire were they? In other words, how much do you think your sort of microcosmic experience reflects on the whole way things were being handled at the Pentagon?
Well, I think it's everything from, the sort of little things that I experienced as an analyst, no voicemail, lack of computers, no regular internet, to sort of much more immediate concerns like the lack of functioning body armor and the Humvees that aren't protected in Iraq. I think sort of at every level, it's these, inconveniences which I think writ large and in the aggregate are extraordinarily harmful, and harmful not only to people, but to morale and to the process.
So let's get specific with your story. Before long, you volunteer for a six-month rotation in Iraq. And before you went over to Baghdad, the Pentagon had you undergo some obligatory cultural training. will you talk about that?
Sure. I just remember I was at Fort Benning in Georgia, which is where most people go before they head overseas to Iraq. And, I was in this huge auditorium with I guess, at least a couple hundred people going through the sort of culture guide to Iraq. And it was things like Arabs are very emotional, so you can't expect them to deal with reality. And so meanwhile, while we're learning those things, more simple cultural things like, in the Arab world, one of the greatest insults is to show someone the bottom of your shoe. But in the military, really in any sort of force protection, the easiest way to control a person is to put your foot on them while on the ground. Just sort of rest your foot. Doesn't have to be anything violent. But in the Arab world, it's a huge insult as opposed to here, where it's sort of, again, an inconvenience.
So those are the lessons you're learning at Fort Benning. Then you get to Baghdad, ready to help hunt down insurgents. But you arrive there and nobody knows what to do with you. Were you stunned at the disorganization?
Yeah, and it was a group of us. It wasn't sort of just me going over, but it was a group of 20 or 25 of us, all who had trained together for a few months and been taking the same classes and doing the same preparation. And it turned out that our leadership in Washington just hadn't really communicated with our leadership in Baghdad. And when we got there, there was already a team doing the stuff that we had planned to start doing. So we had to come up with sort of with a new mission in about 72 hours upon arrival.
So if you can describe it briefly, what was your new mission? What did you do in Baghdad?
So we sort of reoriented ourselves. And the group that I found myself working with after a little while was what we called the direct action team. And that was unique because most of the intel wasn't general enough to pass up to the top and wasn't specific enough to use with military units. And I was one of the few people that was able to do some of that latter work, where I found information about insurgents or sort of bad people and worked to get that to military units on the ground so they could do something with it.
Now, you witnessed some really heartbreaking scenes there. Like, at one point, you participated in a debriefing of some suspected insurgents you'd helped target. Will you describe that scene and what you think went wrong?
Sure, and it was really a turning point. The scene that you describe in the book really sort of marked a departure from when I thought that I was doing really good work that was important, if not necessarily all that efficient or effective, to really believing that our sort of strategy overall was harmful. Because I went to this debriefing that was when people were brought in based on the intelligence that my team and I had gathered, and the military units went out after a few people, but essentially, anyone that they found with or in the locations that they were going to, if they arrived at a house and maybe there was one suspected insurgent and 10 other people in the house, they brought everybody back to be interrogated. But what happened was the military units, and sort of understandably, wanted to send these people to intel folks at the prisons to sort of sort out. But the intel folks figured that anybody that they got from military units was definitely bad. And in that sort of space, you had a lot of people, I mean, thousands of people, who I think were incarcerated just for being at the wrong place at the wrong time.
And in particular, I mean, I was very moved by a story of one person who was arrested, whom he actually couldn't speak, and he was being yelled at, and he had a brother there who was saying, "Where is my, he was asking after his retarded brother." And whose fault do you think it is, AJ?
I think, that particular problem, I think, is largely structural. I mean, I think somebody needs to assign responsibility, and it certainly is farther up the chain than the people on the ground. Someone needs to say, here's who decides who gets incarcerated, who gets detained, and who doesn't. And I think so much of what happens in Iraq is ad hoc and left to sort of anybody who steps up. And there are a lot of people stepping up who just don't have the training or the background to be able to deal with it properly.
So after 6 months in Iraq, you come back to the Pentagon. Surprise, surprise, nobody's expecting you. So you start researching and writing intelligence reports on Iraq. You're an analyst. Will you describe how you and your colleagues constructed literally a wall of optimism to sort of give us a sense of what your work life was like there?
Absolutely. And you spoke earlier about being depressed by the book, and I tried to at least sort of include some things
Yes.
that would get people through it so it wasn't so, upsetting the whole time. And I think the Wall of Optimism was one of the better stories, I guess, despite its content. What happened was analysts and I repeatedly, other analysts and I, would have our supervisors basically say that what we were saying was happening or what was going to happen in Iraq was too pessimistic, that it was off message, that it was, out of line with administration projections. We basically were told to sort of clean it up and to make it look better. And so we started putting like cartoons and phrases literally up on the wall of our office as kind of a joke that anytime we wrote anything that was, depressing or made things sound bad, which of course they were, that we should just look to the wall of optimism so we could change our analysis. And this lasted, I think, over a month. It was sort of openly discussed. It wasn't a big secret or anything. And it just grew and grew. There must have been dozens of things on the wall.
I picture those photos of like a team rowing at sunrise where it's like there's no I in team and it says commitment at the bottom. I mean, another moment of levity, and that also demonstrates how inept your leaders were, was the higher up who couldn't remember your colleague Jose's name, so he kept calling him what, Julio and Juan.
It was basically, I think, any sort of Hispanic name that started with a J. It was fair game,
So, oh, you just said fair game. That's the name of the show. I love when that happens.
yeah.
Love it. All right. So, as you describe it, the manipulation of your intelligence reports to maybe be more optimistic was really out in the open. Did your colleagues in the Pentagon think it was okay for intel to be changed for political purposes?
Yeah, I think it was just sort of so pervasive that it never really got discussed as a real sort of fundamental structural problem. And even I don't think, had a great sense of how damaging it was until I left and started talking to people about these stories. I mean, certainly it wasn't my plan to leave and necessarily write about all this stuff, but people just kept saying like that's sort of talking through the results of that. And I mean, I recognized while I was there how bad it was, but it was something that was just sort of not joked about. I mean, there's sort of a lot of gallows humor about that type of stuff, but it was just so overwhelming that I don't think anyone really individually challenged it too much.
Unfortunately, AJ, we have about a minute left. There's so much more to talk about, but I do want you to explain why you finally decided to quit and how you articulated what you saw as the problems and how you were responded to.
Sure. I think the reason why I decided to quit ultimately was because I felt like, just me personally, that I wasn't doing enough good to make it worth it to stay, that I felt like I could do more good outside the government working on these issues.
Are you hopeful that there'll be changes made?
You know, I am sort of a glutton for punishment, but I really am hopeful. I think that with new leadership, that a lot of it was, I think it went bad so quickly that I think new leadership and a fresh attitude at the top could really make a big beneficial difference.
Finally, AJ, you credit the music of the first American Idol, Kelly Clarkson, with helping you through some tough times in Iraq. And as a proud Kelly Clarkson fan myself, I just I want to commend you, A, for being a guy who confesses to that, and just really making her a part of your patriotic experience.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. There were many a late night with Kelly playing in the background of me watching the shots being fired over the wall. So I felt it was important to include.
AJ, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
AJ Ross Miller is the author of Still Broken, a recruit's inside account of intelligence failures from Baghdad to the Pentagon. For more about him, please visit our website, morefairgame.org.